You should not. 2 Kings chapter 2. I think it's important that each of you understand the reason why we have camp. You know, when you think of camp, I remember when I was younger, my parents used to send me to camp. And when I went to camp, it was, a time of exercise. It wasn't a Christian camp, and therefore there was no emphasis other than the fact that we were to learn certain things. I learned archery, for example. I learned how to swim at camp. I learned some of the basic life-saving devices at camp. I learned how to shoot a .22 rifle at camp. I also learned how to ride horses at camp. And camp was a very exciting time in some respects. And then, of course, in other respects, it really didn't do much as far as molding my character, because, frankly, there was no character emphasis in the camp structure. I think if you take our camps, you can turn the whole thing around and say that everything else other than character building is incidental. The fact that they have games, that's incidental. That's not their main thrust. They're not there to play games. They're there to learn character and how to grow and how to use whatever it is that is being communicated, if nothing else, to challenge them. If I thought, for example, that any camp that I was ever a part of was not designed to mold the character of the young person for future reference, I couldn't support it. I couldn't be a part of it. As a matter of fact, I'd probably do all in my power to destroy it, because, quite frankly, that's not the reason why a camp should exist. And I'll tell you why that's important. We're going to be learning about leadership. I realize that Bob has been holding leadership classes, and this is in no way designed to take away from his thunder, but that's just for a few of you that have been attending those classes. I want you to see what leadership is from the standpoint of the future of our young people. And there's a beautiful illustration used in the passing of the mantle of Elijah to Elisha. That, of course, will be our main study from 2 Kings chapter 2. But more important than that, we've got to learn what true leadership is. May I suggest to you some problems? May I begin by talking in reference to questions? This might be looked at as answering by questions, almost a kind of a Christian Jeopardy thing, you see. You know, what is so-and-so? What is a leader? What constitutes leadership? What makes for a good leader? First question with regard to that. Are leaders born or are they created? Is leadership an integral part of the framework of an individual from birth? Or is it something, as some have suggested, that it's a kind of a pre-conditioning of the soul prior to and as a result of conception? Now, the philosophists and some of the writers in ancient times suggested that somehow it is a combination of the genes, even to the point where this knowledge may even be known prior to conception. The assumption there is that this knowledge is kind of bouncing around somewhere in infinity, and as soon as the individual is born, the two are attached. It's kind of mystical, isn't it? It's more than mystical, it's garbage. That doesn't exist. Another one is a thing that you may have heard from time to time. And that is this good leadership when a man says to another Or a woman says to another, I would never ask my men to do anything that I'm not willing to do myself. Is that good leadership? Is that a good statement? I'm not going to show or ask for a show of hands, because some of you may show your ignorance on the subject, or some of you may disagree with what I'm going to say. So give it a hearing first. Is a leader born a leader? The answer, no. Is a good leader one who says to his men, I would never ask you to do anything that I wouldn't be willing to do myself? It's not a good leader. There are many things that I ask that I wouldn't do myself. I wouldn't even attempt to do it. As a matter of fact, I can't do it. And that's what delegation is all about in leadership. There are things, for example, that I've asked from time to time from Mr. C, Bob Childress. I couldn't do it. Secondly, I wouldn't do it. Thirdly, I can't do it. Fourthly, I don't want to do it. How about that? But a good leader is not one that just comes up with good ideas. Losers do that. I've known people from time to time that had great ideas. You see, a great idea that's never realized is the character of a loser. I found over the years that when I come up with a great idea, I better get that idea either down in writing or transmitted to somebody who is able to facilitate that idea and see it operational quickly. See, a good leader is one who is able to communicate information based on his ideas, whether right or wrong. Not one who just kind of sits around and says, well, this is a good idea, and that's a good idea, and yeah, that should be that way. That's not a leader. That's a thinker that loses. A loser is not one that doesn't think. A loser is not one that just kind of sits around and has a blank. You know, if you were going to read the mental processes on a particular instrument that records mental processes, a loser isn't one that just has a straight line going across. That's not a loser, that's somebody who's brain dead. What's a loser? A loser has a lot of activity going. Sometimes he has too many activities going, and we call that having too many what in the fire? Too many ideas that he's attempting to implement, and none of them get done. That's no good. Bad leadership is when a person is placed in a position of leadership and thinks that because no one else can do it, he's going to do it. That's not leadership. That's a worker who's a leader. Excuse me. That's a worker who's in a leadership position. And he ought not to be. What's going to qualify Elisha to take the place of Elijah? And you know, as I was studying this, this is the real challenge of the hour. There's nothing more thrilling, at least for me. You can be thrilled by other things. But as the pastor of Westside Bible Church for going on now 23, is it? I've lost track.
Almost 30,
thank you. Now it's almost 25. These 25 years, it's been so exciting for me to see young people come up through the ranks and are now leading. But let me tell you something. Let me take a breath so I can say with the next breath, I'm scared about something. I'm not terrified yet, but I'm deeply concerned. And my concern is this. who's going to take their place? I know who's going to take my place. One day I will have the opportunity. I may not be caught up in a whirlwind in a chariot. Now, I may die in a Toyota Camry. That's my chariot. Or BMW or Mercedes, depending upon how I progressed over the years. I have aspirations of advancing vehicularly. Maybe even another Cadillac. I miss my Cadillac. If for no other reason, I used to like to say I have a Cadillac. It may have been 20 years old, but it was a Cadillac. You know, it's funny, if you're driving a 20-year-old Cadillac, that's fine. People say, whoa, you've got a Cadillac. You could be driving a brand new Chevrolet. I know you Chevy owners have a problem with that, but I'd much rather have an old Cadillac than a new Chevy, okay? To me, a 59 Cadillac would be, excuse me, a 55 Cadillac. I'd love to have a 55 Cadillac. Or a 1995 BMW. You say, wait a minute, this is only 91. Well, you see, I'm thinking for the future. But what about the future? You know what frightens me? I remember when some of you were young enough. In fact, I remember when some of you were younger than the ones that I'm looking at now. And now you're in places of leadership. Thank God for people like Gene Cunningham. I never passed the mantle to him, but occasionally I'd let him borrow mine. I thank God for people like Dan Hill. I thank God for people like Larry Hoffman. Because in a strict sense, you see, I was their Elijah, they were my Elisha. I now thank God for, even though he's my son-in-law, that's not important. I don't look at Bob as my son-in-law when we're talking about the work of the ministry and the things of the church. I found out a long time ago that if you cater to family with that regard or cater to anyone because of friendship, you can get yourself in a world of hurt. Because then you become compromising. I remember when some of you came to Westside. You weren't green behind the ears. You were nothing behind the ears. You know, you were blinking teenagers. That kind of thing. Some of you were younger than teens. I remember when some of you were born. See, that's the advantage of being in a local church this long, almost 25 years. Because you can see a person go from infancy all the way up to and prepared, hopefully, for leadership. You see, people, today's young people are tomorrow's leaders. And this nation can only go on the basis of those that lead it. Our churches can only go on the basis of those that lead it. And that's what terrifies me. What I see is, number one, young people that are so self-centered and arrogant, so self-righteous, so selfish, they could never lead. Not effectively. Not in God's plan. Not according to God's protocol. I see others that have already been on drugs. Have already decided to go the wayward way. They're not qualified for future leadership. At least at the present time.
I see others that are not positive to the word. They could care less. We have young people and young adults associated and as a part of Westside Bible Church that I haven't seen in Bible class in months. Hey, they're our future leaders. Who do we pass the mantle to? Who do we say, in effect, here, take over? When they don't even know what they're to take over. That's what I get out of Elijah and Elisha. Let's set the scene for you. It opens in verse 1. As a matter of fact, this could also be looked at, you can almost see it on a stage, the stage of life. We're going to see three basic attitudes. The first attitude is the attitude of the leader who's ready to pass on that leadership to a younger man. The second is the younger man. The younger man who is going to receive that leadership. Whether he be a prophet, whether he be a prep school teacher, whether he be a father. Now, I know it's hard for you to realize, those of you that are in your early teens right now, but let me tell you something, it won't be too long before you're going to be a mother, you're going to be a father, you're going to be a parent, you're going to be. I was saying to you just the other night about the fact that I named John Titus before he was born. I was convinced in my mind that after having three girls in a row, that the Lord was going to give me a boy. And I named him. I even told you that. But you know what? That was 19 years ago. Now he's married. And conceivably, excuse the pun, he could have a family. Some of you are saying, where's the pun? Now, I'm already a grandfather, what, 7 times? Yeah. My oldest granddaughter is what, 14? You know what? I remember when Bob Childress was 14. You say, he was never 14. I think some of you suspect that I was never 14. I was. I wasn't much. But I was a 14-year-old one time. So were you. Who's going to take over? Who's going to carry on? Who are tomorrow's leaders? Where's the Elishas of the future? Don't think that it's a long time off. You see, here's the thing. If we're not mentally preparing our young people for tomorrow, when tomorrow comes, without that preparation, we got nothing. The greatest thing that we can pass on to our children is that heritage of doctrine that we have loved, that we have adored, that has given us what we have today. I think back historically, and I think of, for example, the churches of Asia Minor, the church at Ephesus, the church of Thyatira, the church of Sardis, the church of Philadelphia, the church of Laodicea, the church. They were thriving. Those churches that were located in the Lycus Valley, which is now called Turkey,
They had missionary activities, and Paul wrote letters to them. He wrote to the Colossians. He wrote to the Ephesians. When John, the physical author of the Revelation, wrote to the seven churches in Asia Minor, these are the ones he wrote to. They existed. They were strong. They were growing. They were prosperous. They were sending out people. Now here we are, 2,000 years later. But let me tell you something. You don't go back or ahead 2,000 years to see the failure. It didn't take them 1,000 years, 2,000 years to fail. By the 3rd century A.D., none of those churches existed. They were gone. And it was run over by, and to this day, there isn't one local testimony for Jesus Christ in that entire nation. I had a missionary friend of mine who spoke at our last church, and he was fluent in many, many different languages. As a matter of fact, we used to make fun of him. We shouldn't have, because he spoke the English language beautifully. He enunciated everything very clearly. It's exactly the way he spoke. Remember one night he said, "Pastor, it is intolerably hot in here." Now, we're in New York, you understand, and people don't talk that way in New York. Typical New Yorker would have said, "Hey, it's hot in here. Do something." Something. Something is something. He said, "Can we in any way bring the temperature down?" Everything was overemphasized. He was a missionary to Turkey. He wasn't. If the Turkish officials had known that he was a missionary to Turkey, he would have been imprisoned. Imprisoned. Why? Because it's against the law to be a Christian missionary in Turkey. You cannot speak the gospel in Turkey without being jailed. So he went in as a school teacher, as an educator, and whenever he has opportunities, he would minister. And he said, "You know what's frightening to me?" And I said, "What?" He says, "I've been from one end of the country to the other. I've been to every village and hamlet." And he says, "How many believers do you think I've found?" And I said, "How many?" "None. Not one." That same region that in the first century had 7 Bible teaching doctrinal churches. What happened? No leadership. No perpetuation of that leadership. See, some of you, parents, some of you, young people, are so interested in your own gain, your own life. You haven't learned the basic principle of service to the Lord. And that means sacrifice. That means, what does the Lord have for me? What does He want me to do? I wish I had studied this a week ago. I'd have almost insisted that Bob give me an opportunity to speak this to the young people. I'd have blown them clear out of their seats. But it's a week late in the story of my life. Verse 1, "And it came about," or "it came to pass," as the King James has it, "when the Lord was about to take up Elijah by a whirlwind to heaven, that Elijah went to Gilgal to meet Elisha." So here we have Elisha and Elijah now together. And Elijah said to Elisha, verse 2, "Stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." Now, here's a statement. This is an order that is given by Elijah to Elisha. I know it's difficult for you to remember the names. Just remember the one with the J is the older. The one with the S is the younger. Elijah. Think of him as a bearded person. Elisha. Think of him as a young man. With brown, sandy hair. Okay? With gray blue eyes. I don't know what he looked like. And he says, "Stay here because the Lord has asked me to go where? To Bethel." Now there's an order there. The order is rather simple. Stay here. But you see, you've got to realize that when a leader wants to try or to prove someone that he is going to pass something to and someone to, you've got to find out whether or not this guy is qualified. You're going to see that one of the areas of arrogance is the person that wants to be a leader without climbing the ranks. Arrogance always wants to start at the top. I know young men, for example, that are now coming out of seminary. So they have 5, 6, 9, 10, 15 years of education. They either have a master's degree in theology, a doctorate in theology. They're qualified as pastors on paper. And they want to start at the top. They want large churches. They want churches where they're getting a salary of $100,000 a year. That's the thinking now, by the way. And that includes Dallas Theological Seminary. I just heard something the other day that's rather alarming, because at Dallas they are now psychologically profiling every candidate for graduation to see whether or not they fit the psychiatric profile of a pastor. What does that mean? Some of you are sitting there giving me that look like you think it's a good idea. Well, the ones of you that think it may be a good idea, pray God that you never get one of these misfits that met their profile. We have a student there. He called me yesterday. He's running straight A's. He's going to graduate in December. They called him into the office. Get this. They called him into the office. And they said, "We want you to have psychiatric evaluation." And he said, "Why?" "Because apparently you have a grade syndrome." And he said, "I beg your pardon? You must have A's. And therefore you have a compulsion for grades. And we think that that is an imbalance. And therefore does not qualify you as a pastoral candidate." What? I ran a B average. Do I qualify better? If that's the philosophy, what about the D student? Is he great? Where are we going? What are we doing? See, some of you don't know this stuff. You sit in your homes and you kind of just kind of rock back and forth with a sock in your mouth, and you think life is just... That comes from an old song. Underwear, trying to find another one to chew on, that kind of thing. You remember that? It goes way back. About 1st, 2nd century B.C. It's great in Greek. The average believer doesn't know what's going on out there. How our young men are trying to fill the ranks. And so we have satanic opposition from that aspect as well. I mean, we think of Dallas Theological Seminary. We think of the founder. The founder was Lewis Berry Chafer and C.I. Schofield. These two men got together and they said, we don't know the original languages. We don't know the Greek and the Hebrew. Oh, yes, we've been effective. And my, they were effective. C.I. Schofield, do you have a Schofield reference Bible? Lewis Berry Chafer, do you ever hear about grace? Dispensationalism? The whole concept of what a church should be and how it should be? Do you ever hear the 40 things that accompany salvation? 33 of them came right out of Lewis Berry Chafer's book on systematic theology. Now they're discrediting Lewis Berry Chafer. Moody Bible Institute is now discrediting A.T. Robertson, one of the exponents of the Greek language. I fear that it won't be long before one of them will actually take a stand and say, I think we should discredit Jesus Christ himself. That's where it's headed. Psychiatric evaluation for pastoral candidates to see whether or not they fit the profile? Well, Elijah didn't do that. But he did put Elisha to the test. You know what it was? By telling him to stay there. You say, well, he should have obeyed then. No. See, here is where disobedience is obedience. Look, if the Lord has laid something upon your heart, your mind, and you know that you are going to follow the footsteps of Elijah, and your name is Elisha, and you know that you've got to be as close to Elijah as possible because you know that at any moment God could take Elijah from your presence, and you want that blessing, you want that same power, you want what Elijah has, you're not going to stay in Bethel and let him go somewhere else. So notice the response. Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, please, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel. But Elisha said, as the Lord lives. You may not realize that, but that really is an oath, a statement reflecting an oath that he had taken. And as you yourself live, I will not leave you. So they went down to Bethel. Verse 3, here are the third set of characters. These are the young people. This is very important, especially for tonight's service. If you don't come tonight, you're going to have some thing just floating around in your mind. Of course, it'll also separate those who are interested in learning not only the word, but the future of our country and the future of Westside Bible and the future of the leadership of tomorrow. These are the young people, the sons of the prophets. And they're going to come on the scene as well. And they're going to say certain things to Elijah and Elisha. They're also going to say things later to Elisha himself And they're all mixed up. For example, anticipating this evening, listen to this one. Young people. These are young people. They're the sons of the prophets. What's the implication there? They're the ones that are going to take over what? When the prophets are gone, right? You agree? Yeah. Sons of the business. Business being prophets. There are 50 of them. Well, here we are with 50 again. Elisha has gone with Elijah. He's gone to various places in obedience to the Lord. And then Elijah says to him, "What is it you seek? What would you like?" And Elisha says, "I want double the portion that you have." Whoa! "I want double the power that you have." In other words, I want to make double the impact on society. What a desire. You know what the average young person thinks today? "I want to go on welfare. I want the government to do something for me. I want a free ride." There's a rare one. Boy, you get a hold of this guy, you write him down, Elisha. And so Elijah says to him, "Okay, here's the stipulation. If you see me leave, you'll get that double portion. Now, are you going to stick close by this guy? If your name is Elisha, are you going to stay close to Elijah?" Man, I'll tell you, you got your eyes glued on him. Why? Because you've purposed that you want double, so you're like this. Elijah says, "I'll be right back." "No, you won't. But I have to go into the bushes." "I'm going with you. The Lord may call him. There he is." You know what I see in that? Importunity. Desire and facilitation of that desire. Not just desire. Here's our young people today. What? And then mix them in with some drugs. And then it's, "Who am I?" Even our girls in the back row, there's one of them back there that has the span of attention of a frog. I'd expect more out of a turtle than I'd expect out of her. I'm going to protect her privacy, however, because now she's listening to me. Mr. C warned you. The next step will be that person will stand. And then everybody will know. All right, Elijah goes up. The mantle drops to the ground. And he's taken up in a chariot in a whirlwind. What a sight! Whew, it's gone. And I'm sure Elisha said something like, in Hebrew, of course, "Wow!" Something like that. And he looks down and there's the mantle, and he puts the mantle on himself after he'd rent his clothes. That simply is an expression of grief. Then he puts the mantle on. Now, he comes to the same place where he and Elijah had been a few days before. The River Jordan. Elijah had separated the waters of the River Jordan. You know, you think that Moses was the only one who did that. No, Elijah did it. Matter of fact, he said, "Separate!" And they walked across. Now, he comes to it. And here's Elisha now. He's got the mantle on. Okay, and he says, it's a test for him. How did he do that again? And then he said, "Lord, if you be the God of Elijah, and I have this, do it to it." And they separated. You think Elisha was a little bit surprised? Whoa, it worked! Now he gets on the other side. The 50 are waiting for him. And they said, I'm going to be very King James about this. Thou art Elisha, the Spirit of the Lord is upon thee. Thou hast the power of Elijah. Thanks, fellas. I just parted the waters. Now their next statement. We're going to go look for Elijah. What? Yeah, you see, he's not with you, right?
Right.
The Lord may have taken him and dropped him off on some mountain. Don't you get it? Here's a leader. Now he's got advisors. And so he says, don't go. I know where he went. Oh, no, they said. And they kept on, and they kept on, and they kept on. And so finally, he says, all right, go. The New American Standard, I think, misses it. It says, and they got him to the point where he was ashamed. Ashamed of what? I think it should be read. It got him to the point where he finally was disgusted. Said, all right, go. So they go out and they're looking for whom? For Elijah. Where is Elijah? He's with the Lord. And they come back. And guess what? There's not one word about the fact that they couldn't find him. There's an implication there. But instead, they come back with two more ideas. You say, and what are those ideas? I'll see you tonight. Hold your breath. What's going to make for a good leader? Elijah's attitude? Right. Elisha's attitude? Right. Your attitude? I don't know what your attitude is. I remember a young Marine just before he shipped over to Guam. It was Guam, wasn't it? Iwo Jima. Wasn't Iwo either, was it? Okinawa. Got it right. It's one of those islands. One of the ones we took from the Japanese during World War II, then gave back with Toyotas. Anyway, young, desirous, type, gung-ho, spent his time in service, married one of my adopted daughters, leader, West Side Bible. I remember another one that came in, he had a lot of kids then. Or at least he was making them. And I remember going clear over to, where was it, Chandler, Mesa, the other side of the world. You needed a passport. They stop you and they say, passporti please. And I say, they say, you're going to visit McGuire's yet? Well, you need a passport. Leader. When they came here, were they leaders? They were, ooh, that's the beginning of leader. Ooh. They had the L, okay? If I forgot you, don't get mad. I didn't do it purposely. I'm just using them as an illustration, okay? I can't use all of you as illustrations because you're not all leaders. I remember when the colonel came in. And the colonel passed the mantle. The the success of West Side is not because of me. You'll never get it unless you see what the future can hold and you're in it. Well, how do you see yourself in 10 years from now? Where do you see yourself in 10 years from now? Or don't you just give a damn? Or do you think the way you start is at the top? Now, I don't care what your background is. No one starts at the top. I started as a shepherd. You know why? The Lord wanted to teach me something about sheep. I didn't know anything about sheep. I was raised in New York City. What would I know about sheep? There are no sheep in New York City. There are a lot of goats. A lot of donkeys, too. But no sheep. So the Lord says, I want you to take care of sheep. There I was stuck with 600 ewes. That's good New York. Ewes guys, all females. And I used to visit them in the morning. I'd say, good morning, ladies. They could care less. God was training me. He was saying, one day you're going to stand before a congregation, and I've called them sheep, and you better know what they are and what they do and how they act. And I found out you can't bring them to the water and make them drink. I almost drowned one once. It was an accident. I picked her up, little lamb. I picked her up and I said, she was coughing. Too much dust. And I said, here's water. Drink. We have an expression in Greek, it says, tipota. You know what that means? Nothing. And so I took her little snoot and I kind of dipped it in the water. Well, that was nice. She wasn't very positive for the water of the word. And so I said, well, then I'm going to put your head in it. And I stuck her head in it. And bubbles came up and she was kicking and doing and so on. And I finally pulled her head out of the water because if I'd left her there any longer, I'd have killed her. How much water did she drink? None. Not a drop. And I put her on the ground and I let her go and she went coughing off into the sunset. I knew what was best for her. All she had to do, all she had to do was take a drink of water. That's all you need, lady. She wouldn't do it. Taught me something. Let her teach me. You can lead a lamb to doctrine, but you can't force him to drink. All you got to do is provide the water and say to them, there it is. You're going to drink it? Fine. If you're not, then go through life coughing. Now, of course, they were being prepared for something. You say, yeah, lamb dinner. Well, yeah. I'm not preparing you for the slaughter. Why do we have the school? Because we think it'd be so nice to tax 5 or 6 teachers and pay them practically nothing to put up with 100 kids. That's why we have the school. You see, deep down inside, we are really sadists. And that sadism is expressed in confronting our teachers with these children. No. No. Because in the mind of every single one of them, and if it's not there, they won't last, is this basic attitude. These are the leaders of tomorrow. Let's pray you're dismissed. Thank you, Father, for the challenge of your word this morning. Open our minds and understanding to these things that we may realize how important a part we play in life, not for our own gratification, but to thy plan, to thy purposes, to thy glory. Dismiss us now, we ask, in Christ's name. Amen. See you tonight, 7 o'clock. Don't miss tonight.